Horses across Hounslow. The family lived above the stables. There was no electricity at first, only a coal fire in the living room. During winter, you could take a glass of water to bed with you and find it frozen into a block of ice by morning. If one of the horses fell ill, the children would lie awake listening to it pawing the floors. Then their father would go downstairs, and that was the last they would see of him until breakfast time. Betty Winnett moved to Gunnersbury Park in 1935, 7 years after her father started working there as a groundskeeper in charge of the stables. Betty's husband Arthur remembers his father-in-law as a sort of Victorian-type father. Whatever he said went, and everybody obeyed him. And yet to this man, who was indeed born in the time of Queen Victoria, the horses were like children. Betty says, "He used to say a horse was lovely. You could even speak with it." The family bathroom was piled high with horse liniments, lotions for sores and minor wounds, and if one of the children hurt themselves, Betty's father would prescribe a salve of horse oil for their cuts and bruises. The family's move to Gunnersbury Park coincided with the taking into public hands of some of the great estates of Hounslow and with the final years of horse-drawn transport into and out London. But horses would continue to play an important role as draft animals, dragging heavy equipment from place to place until the middle of the 20th century. At Gunnersbury Park, they were used to tow the mechanical mowers that the newly formed Gunnersbury Park Joint Committee, the municipal body in charge of the park's day-to-day running, had bought at a cost of £125, equivalent to over £7,000 in today's money. The horses were integral to this new machinery, part of the efficient maintenance of the park in the public interest. They themselves were highly valued. A bay-coloured Clydesdale-type gelding, a well-known Scottish breed, named Tony, was insured for £110 in 1947. Great pride was invested in these animals. The superintendent of Gunnersbury's joint committee entered the horses in local competitions and offered a special prize that other park carters could win with their own animals. Gunnersbury Park in the early to mid-20th century was a place of work, of difficult and heavy labour. But at the same time, it was a place of revelry, a place where sheep grazing vied for space with equestrian sporting competitions. What Betty witnessed was the transition of the horse from a working animal, a living, breathing motor, into a purely ceremonial creature. It was urbanisation that massively increased the demand for horses. More city dwellers meant more people to feed and more human traffic to move from place to place. In urban peripheries like Hounslow, agriculture responded to the growing demands of the city. Horse-powered mechanical harrows, mowers and rakes allowed farmers to cover ground more quickly. What the horse lacked in strength compared to the ox, it easily made up for in speed. Meanwhile, horse-drawn coaches from London, or from the great country estates such as Gunnersbury House, raced across Hounslow Heath to reach Bath, Bristol and Portsmouth. They followed the great western roads laid down by the Romans. It could be a bumpy and dangerous ride. One traveller from the 1780s recalls how he gave up his seat on top of a coach to take refuge in the luggage basket. The machine rolled along with prodigious rapidity over the stones till we got clear of London. All the boxes, hobnailed and copper fastened, began to dance around me. Everything in the basket seemed to be alive, and every moment I received such violent blows that I thought my last hour had come. Ending your journey with bruises or being flung into a ditch was not the only danger. Until at least the 1830s, highwaymen stalked the heath, including the infamous Dick Turpin. Many of the highwaymen of the 18th century were former butchers and cattle drovers. Butchers in those days were proud and independent artisans, but the growth of large-scale wholesalers made their trade increasingly precarious. Some turned to the underground economies of robbery and smuggling in the hope of regaining their lost independence. They knew the highways well from their work herding cattle, pigs and geese from the fattening pastures to the north and west of the city. They knew the heaths and commons from the various inns and stopping points en route, where they could gamble, drink, exchange news and strike deals. This was the landscape of the highwayman, a place where the rattle of coach wheels merged with the squawks and squeals of animals being driven to market, where the clear borders of turnpiked roads dissolved into the grasses, gorses, riverbanks and trees of the heath. The highwayman's independence from mainstream economics and his fame in popular legend could not be tolerated. New systems of credit, so that large sums of gold and silver no longer had to be carried on one's person, plus the introduction of mounted patrol units, a forerunner of the modern police, eventually made his illicit existence impossible. The triumph of a new economic system went hand in hand with organised violence. The hangman's scaffolds that peppered the heath were testimony to this history. This was not the first time that armed men on horseback had clashed on Hounslow Heath. In the 1640s, there were battles between royalist and parliamentary forces. Indeed, some of the highwaymen were ex-soldiers, cast-offs from the Civil War period, who found it difficult to get work once the army had no use for them. Following riots in London, the king had stationed 13,000 troops on Hounslow Heath to overawe the mutinous people. But after a while, Londoners must have realised that the camp was mostly there for show. It became known as a fun place to visit during public holidays. According to one historian, the camp presented the appearance of a vast fair, mingled with the musketeers and dragoons, a type of horse-mounted infantry, a multitude of fine gentlemen and ladies from Soho Square, sharpers and painted women from Whitefriars, invalids in sedans, monks in hoods and gowns, lackeys in rich liveries, peddlers, orange girls, mischievous apprentices, and gaping clowns was constantly passing through the long lanes of tents. Once again, a life that revolved around horses mixed revelry with work, and in this case, war. It was probably serving with the Royal Artillery during the First World War that Betty's father got his love of horses. Millions of them were used to haul ammunition and supplies to the front. And on the British side alone, almost 500,000 were killed. After the war, Betty's father worked as a laundry cart driver. Carts that were drawn, of course, by horses. That was before he got the job at Gunnersbury Park. The work there was not well paid, but it was stable. And for that reason, relatively coveted, at least amongst older generations. Along with stability, there was also great camaraderie among Gunnersbury staff. Regular outings to the coast, annual dinners at the King's Head pub in Acton, cricket matches and sometimes free fruit and vegetables were all small forms of compensation for the poor pay. The park with its beautiful gardens was in many ways a little world in itself, a place that could be both idyllic and isolating. As a child, Betty remembers foraging for mushrooms in the autumn leaf piles. In summer, she would receive peaches from the conservatories. If you think of living in the country, it was part like that. But at night, when the gates and everything were closed, you could get a shut-in feeling. Right up until adulthood, the park, and particularly the stables, were at the centre of Betty's life. Her and her husband Arthur even got married from the stables. One of the gardeners gave them lilies to decorate inside. And for the wedding meal, there were sweet peas and salads. Betty and Arthur moved out of the stables in 1951, 4 years after they had married. Betty's parents stayed on until the early 60s, up until her father stopped working, up until the time of the accident. Betty remembers it like this. Dad was good, if he could do anything for you, but he had his own way of life and he didn't like any touching. He was a hard worker. He really was, wasn't he? A very hard worker. But however they ever stayed there, I really don't know. And of course he had an accident to his foot. One of the horses bolted and he tried stopping it, and the horse, I don't know if he trod on him or what it did, but it broke his ankle, didn't it? And he was off work for quite a while with it, and then eventually he had his leg amputated, so that wasn't very good at all. But he was 69 then. I mean, he'd done very well indeed, and he had it amputated and he had to get out of the park because he was no use to anyone then. After the accident, Betty says her father lost heart. There was no compensation for the accident. Betty says her father became bitter. He tore up all his beautiful old photographs. But the seed of his more than understandable grievance against his employers, against the world they represented, had been sown many years earlier. There was a little bit of resentment from most of the men that worked there, that were doing the job but not getting very good money. But as I say, the older men accepted that. But the younger ones coming in used to leave and say, well, I'm not standing for this, you know, I'll go elsewhere. But it depends on your circumstances and the way you looked at life. Dad was in there after he was 40. He was fairly safe. And I think after going through the First World War, I don't think you worried too much about the other things. What comfort and even love Betty's father found in the horses he looked after is difficult to reckon with. A generation that lived through two world wars and that saw these animals as their daily working companions, if not as their brothers in arms, would too often be betrayed by the masters they served. The waning of aristocratic and noble elites from the public scene and the advance of state, municipal and commercial powers did not necessarily change this pattern, at least not frequently or thoroughly enough. And yet, in the second half of the 20th century, a new generation was growing up that not only recognised this hurt, but increasingly refused to abide by it.